presentation that I am going to facets that you're discussing now, and perhaps we can return to that after that. Our next speaker will be Professor Jerry McDade of the English Department of Drexel University.
Yes, thank you. A lot of the things I'm going to make, I'm not going to make a speech. I'm just going to make some remarks that I've noted. A number of the things that I've heard this afternoon here apply quite directly, I think, to the educational system. Like, the first question that occurs to me is, I suppose my topic is the effects of the war on the students in the university. Of course, the immediate question that occurs to me is, where are they? The students are not here. 10 months ago, you wouldn't be able to breathe in this room. And the question then becomes, it would have been packed. You know, where are they? They're watching Villanova play UCLA. Marvelous. You know, right? Well, the next question that occurs to me is, why? Well, it's a lot easier to watch Villanova play UCLA, but I was impressed by the question concerning the ethos and with some of the business about conditioning and military training, because in a very real sense, all the questions which people like Carl Rogers raise about the educational system in the United States are quite, I think, applicable to the situation, the absence of students here today or yesterday or at any of the anti-war rallies in the last 8 months. What we find within the university structure and the high school, the grade school structure is a series of, as you said, humiliations, situations which lead people to conform, to follow more than anything else what is orderly, what appears to be demanded of them rather than what they actually feel or think they should be doing. And ultimately, of course, this prepares them beautifully not for democracy but for military training. If you begin to think about the whole educational system in this kind of light, I think you can understand perhaps why it's collapsing, which is not a necessarily bad thing. But I wanted to make a few comments about the students today, as I've observed them in the last, we just finished a 10-week term over at Drexel, and I've also taught at Temple and LaSalle and Villanova, curiously. So I know a little bit about the students in this area. I think the first thing that impresses me is their incredible, and it surprised me too, with the exception of one or two experts in every class, there's a really an incredible lack of information about the war. On top of that, there's a fantastic desire not to believe anything that's reported. I, for example, came in and read the 26 pages of testimony, selected testimony, to my students, and I read a letter from Philip Berrigan, and they didn't believe me. One student raised his hand and said, well, where's the other side of the story? Which is, you know, I suppose a valid question. Another day, I in the past 10 weeks, I played the Sam Ervin's played an FM radio of Sam Ervin's committee investigating the investigations of Army intelligence, right? One student looked at me with such incredible anger. How can you do this to me? How can you make me listen to this? And I had to explain to them that I was not a ventriloquist, that I wasn't making all this up, and that this was really happening. Well, now, what has happened to all, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the atrocity. I was coming over here yesterday because I thought the panel was scheduled yesterday, and I met one of my students who had worked very hard for several months on the Cambodia strike. And he said, where are you going? So I said, oh, I'm going over to Penn and I'm going to, you know, just talk a little bit about students. I said, if you're not doing anything, why don't you stop over? He said, oh, I'm doing something. And that was it. What I think happened is students like me, I was a student once in 61, we're dealing, I think, with waves of students. The people like me and others, I suppose, Mark, we were products of those early teach-ins when people got a great deal of information massively. And I think then after that there was a huge wave of relatively less informed people whose feelings were, as it were, in the right place and against the war. I think what is happening now is we are experiencing a wave of students or a generation of students who have felt the boot of law and order at home, this incredible kind of reaction. You know, your older brother or sister got away with this, but you're not going to get away with this. And I can sense this in class. They're sort of divided into two groups, the ones who, you know, are relatively straight-looking, and then the freaks who are really long-haired law and order freaks. There's a lot of them. They have their Rizzo buttons, you know, and things like that. I guess I can't say that. Well, all of these kids, I think, got together on Cambodia. I think Cambodia brought them together. I think it was just what they needed to stimulate their index of outrage. But I think at the same time, Kent State and Jackson State and Kansas State, which is one, unfortunately, people forget all the time, really scared the shit out of them. I think for the first time they said something like this: these people are crazy. They're really crazy. They will really kill their children. So in a sense, I can't, you know, I can sympathize with the way many of these students feel. I know that the media keeps telling us that the students are doing their own thing, they're doing a study thing. Well, if they are, it isn't evident to me, and it isn't evident to anybody else I know in the academic profession. If they're doing a study thing, they must be doing it very surreptitiously. And I know one thing: if they're doing it, they're not happy about it. Because one of the prevailing topics on campus that I've found, anyway, this term, has been death. And one of my students said to me about 2 weeks ago, well, it's in the air, you know, it's a kind of zeitgeist or something. But they're not happy about it. And I sense that, therefore, you know, the media is right to this extent, that they feel frustrated and they feel disgusted. I think that there are reasons for that, of course, obvious reasons. They are scared. I think also that in large measure, I noticed that Mark's going to read something about the Declaration of Scholars and Professionals, but I don't know how it is with you, but I think on at least most of the people I know in the academic community are simply turned off entirely. They've simply decided that it is no longer worth it to talk about the war, and so they don't. That's not a very hopeful position, except that I think what I'm getting around to saying is that we simply cannot rely on the students, and that's why I think the Veterans Organization is so important. The veterans have been there. They can come out and say, look, I am not talking about something I read in the IF Stone biweekly. I'm talking about something I saw. You may not wish to believe me. That's your business. But I think if the veterans more or less lead the way and we more or less leave the students alone a while, perhaps they'll realize that the feelings they had 10 months ago were legitimate feelings, honest feelings. I don't know. I told you I wasn't going to make a speech.
Okay. As a student,
yeah.
Maybe one of the students here.
Right.
I'd like to comment that.
Here, why don't you take that?
No. Very sure. I think you're right about the idea that you can't really trust students to be on anything for very long, because when we get involved with things, it tends to be, when we get really involved with things, it tends to be highly emotional type thing.
Right.
We're on a big high with it. And it just runs on a peak of energy for 2 or 3 weeks, and that's the maximum.
And it collapses.
I'm from Swarthmore College, which is supposed to be a big radical center. What has happened is there are some radicals there, all right, but they're not on campus.
May I say something about that? There was a headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer right after the Cambodian invasion, which Attorney General Mitchell said that the moderate, well-financed students would be in a better position to co-opt the so-called radicals this fall, and I think they were quite well-financed. I think that has gone on in the campuses. And I think something else I've observed, a lot of the so-called radicals on the campus have been kicked off for various ruses. I'm looking at one of them. Go ahead.
Well, I wasn't kicked off, but...
No, I wasn't looking at you.
Yeah, well, a number of our people were kicked off, but mostly for, you know, academic reasons. Right. I almost flunked out myself, but they gave a number of us sort of pardons if we promised to be good economics majors or whatever. What we have done is go off campus with our concerns and join organizations off campus.
Right.
Like, I'm now doing all my schoolwork on the basis of what it'll do for this off-campus research organization, rather than what it'll get me in grades. It just strikes me that you can't count on college campuses to be anything better, all that much more concerned than any sort of segment of society in general. You have a few sort of really good people who are together, as you were saying, the products of the early teachings, and then some followers who will follow on as a sort of faddish type thing.
I think we can't underestimate the extent to which a number of people, I would say, between 17 and 21 have felt this law and order boot at home. I think that this is a very important thing, you know.
I think we'd better go on and perhaps save any further questions for the conclusion. I'm Dr. Mark Sakharov of Temple University, and I've been involved in a study of war crimes since around 1967. And what I'd like to do is to establish a kind of historical context for this whole problem and perhaps make a kind of estimate of what might happen in this area. Around 1967, the Russell Tribunal in Stockholm was the first formal effort to confront American citizens with the reality of widespread war crimes in Vietnam. The effect of that tribunal was virtually nil in this country for a variety of reasons, mainly that the tribunal took place on a foreign soil, and the American press was very hostile to the tribunal, and the tribunal itself was composed of members of fairly radical left groups. And so consequently, in spite of the fact that very much of the material that was revealed there was incontrovertibly true, the final effect was almost nothing in the United States. Essentially, the American citizens refused to believe these allegations as far back as 1967. However, in 1968, the Clergy and Laymen Concerned published a book called In the Name of America, which many people innocently believed would mark the end of the war, because almost everything you've heard in the last 2 days was in some form revealed in this book in 1968, and in great detail. And it was very well organized legally. There was a legal framework by Professor Richard Falk, which identified exactly what law, international law, was being violated and gave the details of evidence of the violations. So I would say then that the third important event in this brief history was, of course, the My Lai massacre and the consequences which the My Lai massacre created. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but since the My Lai massacre, at least 12 books have been written on U.S. war crimes in the United States. This in itself is a kind of event, and it's part of the whole picture as it's evolving. The existence of these 12 books and of approximately 20 others which were written between 1967 and the present has created a great corpus of information that is available to the people of the United States, and now I think we have reached the point where the peak of this knowledge is about to be reached, and that is that tomorrow in the Sunday Times in the book review section, the lead review, which will take up almost half of the book review section, will be on these books on war crimes. It will be written by Neil Sheehan, and essentially it has taken the position
that is reflected in these books, namely that the United States has, for the last 5 years or 6 years, been engaged in a policy which is inherently criminal. He doesn't quite editorialize to this extent, but it's quite clear from the reading of the article that he has moved very much over to the position of those who believe that our policy is criminal, whereas in 1968, as some of you know, his position was much more lenient. So I've been trying in various ways to mobilize the intellectual community and the professional community, because I believe, perhaps naively, but I hope eventually not naively, that one of the most important components in the dissolution of the war is the professional community, the establishment figures, whose complicity in the war is one of the most important factors in its being able to continue. And so I have written a statement called Declaration of Scholars and Professionals Concerned About U.S. War Crimes, and I will read you parts of it. There are many allegations about war crimes, but before we can consider the merits of these allegations, we must deal with a question which frequently and naturally arises. Why do veterans and numerous books on U.S. war crimes say little or nothing about the atrocities of the other side? A full answer to this question would have to be many-sided. First, the combat veterans have had little or no eyewitness experience of atrocities by the other side, and hence cannot testify extensively about them. Likewise, researchers have found that even if we take U.S. reports of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese atrocities at their face value, the violations by the enemy are, compared to ours, not extensive enough to warrant unusual scrutiny. Rather, they approach the level of random individual atrocities, which are unfortunately inevitable in warfare. Nevertheless, one book, Edward S. Herman's Atrocities in Vietnam, has indeed explored the available data on enemy violations and has attempted to compare their magnitude with those of U.S. and ARVN forces. Another reason for the relative silence on the war crimes of the other side is that the Nuremberg proceedings clearly established that the allegation of violations by the other side is not a legal defense against a charge of war crimes. Moreover, as the clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam suggested in their book In the Name of America, crimes of war are a moral as well as a legal problem, and our own large-scale violations remain our own moral problem, whereas those of the other side are their own. It is an easy and dangerous evasion, the clergy and laymen pointed out, to counter accusations by saying that the other side is just as bad or worse. Finally, the question of scale and technology seems decisive on this question. U.S. forces have used over 450 times more firepower than the enemy, and we have at our disposal bombers, artillery, napalm, defoliants, and anti-personnel weapons. The enemy lacks all of these except a small amount of artillery. But it is precisely the bombs, napalm, and the rest that are the main instruments of war crimes. For once we study this subject closely, we learn that face-to-face atrocities by individual soldiers, such as the wanton murder of women and children by rifle fire, are far less destructive of innocent human life than the indiscriminate use of heavy weaponry, of which we have almost exclusive possession. Hence, eyewitnesses and researchers have given the greatest attention to the principal offender. A look at the data on U.S. expenditure of firepower and other weapons should make clear the colossal excessiveness of our military operations. Moreover, it should become equally clear that the nature of the war we are fighting makes it almost inevitable that we must use our advanced weaponry primarily against civilian populations. One, we have, according to the Pentagon, used over 10 million tons of ordnance, that is bombs, mortar, and bullets, in Indochina, over 450 times more than the enemy has used. Two, Arthur Galston, Yale biologist, reports that we have sprayed about 5 million acres, or 12% of the land in South Vietnam, with 100 million pounds of herbicide chemicals. Our crop destruction program, supposedly aimed at the Viet Cong, actually causes starvation primarily among women and children. Moreover, a recent statement by Army sources, December 31, 1971, reveals that the Army knew as early as 1967 that the crop destruction was causing deaths by starvation primarily among civilians, but decided to continue the program anyway. Three, by 1969, US B-52s had used, had left 3.5 million bomb craters on the terrain of South Vietnam. Little imagination is required to judge how many people and homes must have existed where those 30-foot malaria-breeding craters now deface the countryside. Four, the amount of tear gas, or CS, used also vastly exceeds what we would expect for normal military operations, 14 million pounds. Contrary to Defense Department claims, CS is not regularly used to save enemy lives, for combatants are often shot while incapacitated, and non-combatants are often flushed out of hiding by CS and then become vulnerable to rifle fire, artillery strikes, and bombings. Five, according to NARMIC's study, Weapons for Counterinsurgency, and Thomas Rydell's Efficiency in Death, 105 U.S. companies manufacture a variety of anti-personnel weapons for use in Indochina. These weapons have no application except against human beings. They are used in situations which makes it impossible to distinguish between combatants and civilians. They produce irregular, hard-to-cure wounds. Some of them can saturate an area the size of a football field with a lethal spray of bullets. One of them, napalm, is too notorious to require description, but the less-known phosphorus is even worse. Altogether, the data on the manufacture and use of anti-personnel weapons reflect an unrestrained and repellent use of technology against defenseless human beings in a manner that flagrantly transgresses any residual concept of fairness in warfare. The results of this saturation of Indochina for over 6 years with weapons of destruction are quite predictable. An advanced industrial nation cannot rain instruments of death in profuse amounts upon the peoples and countrysides of undefended agrarian nations without expecting dire results in human and ecological devastation. Thus, the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Refugee and Civilian Casualty Problems estimates that 1 million South Vietnamese have been wounded, of whom 300,000 have died primarily as a result of U.S. firepower. But Edward S. Herman, in his Atrocities in Vietnam, calculates that the figure for the wounded is more like 2 million, with the death toll at an additional 1 million. And Telford Taylor's estimate is closer to Herman's. The Senate Subcommittee and other sources assert that 6 million South Vietnamese people have been displaced at some time from their original homes since 1964, again primarily by U.S. bombings and artillery strikes. Moreover, civilian amputees in South Vietnam number 105,000, military amputees number 51,000, orphans 250,000, and war widows 131,000, a total of 545 war victims apart from refugees. In addition, the cities now teem with a huge underclass of dislocated people who have become thieves, shoeshines, prostitutes, an estimate is 400,000, and boy pimps and drug pushers. The situation in Laos, where the bombing has been less publicized but more intense, is proportionately grave. Out of a population of 3 million, at least 200,000 have died as a result of the bombings, and 700 to 800,000 have become refugees. Thus, over a third of a nation has suffered death or the ordeal of disruption since 1964, while an undetermined number are among the wounded. Similarly, in Cambodia, 1 million Cambodians are already refugees as a result of our air support, while 400,000 ethnic Vietnamese have either fled or been displaced. The military practices just described, which lead to unnecessary and excessive loss of lives and to dislocation, maiming, and social upheaval, are at the same time all violations of international conventions to which the United States has solemnly subscribed. For example, Hague 4, Article 25 states, quote, "The attack or bombardment by whatever means of towns, villages, dwellings, or buildings which are undefended is prohibited." Similarly, the very concept of the free fire zone, which treats non-combatants as combatants, clearly violates the Geneva Convention of 1949, Article 3.1, which states, persons taking no active part in the hostilities shall in all circumstances be treated humanely. Again, the wanton destruction of homes by bombing, artillery, and Zippo squads contravenes Hague 4, 23G, 4, 46, and Geneva 53. Massive reprisals against whole villages for sniper fire is in violation of Geneva 33. Additionally, the forcible transfer of refugees into barbed wire camps is manifestly unlawful, according to Geneva 49. And the growing moral erosion and contempt for international law on the part of the U.S. government is quite evident in the recent disclosure in the New York Times that we are planning a massive relocation of South Vietnamese. Estimates run from 200,000 to 2 or 3 million because they are considered hardcore Viet Cong sympathizers. Undoubtedly, the defenders of our war policies can bring forward numerous military and legal rationalizations for these destructive military practices. Military necessity will predictably stand out among these. However, as General Telfer Taylor has written, quote, "The military end sought should be sufficient to warrant the suffering and destruction inflicted." The famous slogan, "War is hell," is also inadequate and misleading. For as Father Robert Drynan writes, it is a deceptive bromide, quote, "that all war produces excruciatingly difficult circumstances and that consequently it is impossible to mitigate the inhumane aspects of modern warfare." The slogan is thus quite disingenuous and represents an attempt with the shrug of the shoulders to obtain a carte blanche for unrestrained destructiveness and a license to maximize rather than minimize human suffering and warfare. No doubt the heavy bombing by both sides during World War II produced an unspoken change of philosophy about bombing among civilized nations, and some apologists for the military cite this kind of bombing as a defense of ours. But we must recognize the substantial difference between the bombardment of an advanced society defended by anti-aircraft guns, bomb shelters, and an advanced warning through radar, and the bombardment of villages consisting of huts with no comparable protection or retaliatory force. The first is a regrettable clash between two strong and reasonably equal powers. The second is the unleashing of overwhelming force against a weak nation and against defenseless peasants. Similarly, the Allies utterly devastated Dresden and Frankfurt during World War II, and the United States annihilated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Some defenders of our U.S. actions in Indochina cite these examples almost as if they are legal precedents justifying our present behavior. But the obliteration of an entire city with deaths in the neighborhood of 100,000 has no justification from military necessity or from any immediate military end. And thus, those acts of World War II were outright terroristic raids designed to frighten the surviving enemy into submission. Hence, although these raids were not realistically justiciable at Nuremberg, they were themselves impartially viewed war crimes and can hardly be used to justify present tactics. Again, the failure of the enemy in Indochina to abide by